Future City is made possible by McCormick & Company. Through its Flavor for Life program, McCormick helps teach kids and families in Baltimore how to replace salt, sugar, and fat. More information can be found at McCormickCorporation.com.
Welcome to Future City here on 88.1 WYPR. I'm Dr. Kalima Young. Every month on Future City, we discuss innovative responses to the city's most pressing issues and where we move the conversation from what's wrong to what's next. Today on the show, we're discussing different ways people use public space to reflect on and respond to collective grief and cultural trauma. How does a city create a container for holding cultural trauma and collective grief? Why is it necessary? What role does art play in helping shape the container? What infrastructures need to be in place to successfully hold a myriad of types of public and collective grief? Later in the show, we'll talk about how cities can hold space for systemic trauma with Erica Bridgeford, the co-founder of Baltimore Ceasefire 365, as well as personal trauma with an in-depth discussion with Hannah Brancato of The Monument Quilt. But first, we will talk about ways to address historical trauma by speaking with Will Schwartz. He is the president and founder of the Maryland Lynching Memorial Project, a volunteer organization that works to honor the lives of dozens of victims of lynching in the state of Maryland. Will Schwartz, thank you for joining us on Future City.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Yay. So how did the Maryland Lynching Memorial Project come to be?
So I refer to myself as an accidental activist because it's not something that I had really ever thought would be a part of my life. But I'm going to give you the Reader's Digest version here. A few years ago, Bryan Stevenson was on his book tour for Just Mercy. And a friend of mine in a book club that I belong to is a federal public defender. And he told me that about Bryan and his reputation. And this was before the movie. I mean, it was, the book that had just come out. And so I read the book and I went to see him and I was completely blown away, floored. But in the course of that discussion, of the book talk, he also mentioned that EJI, the Equal Justice Initiative, had just completed its first report on lynching in America, and that they had documented more than 4,500 lynchings in the United States, the racial terror lynching that had occurred. Mm-hmm. This just completely stopped me in my tracks. And I'm not proud of this, but I had no idea. I had no sense at all of the scale of this problem, of the depravity of these murders, and I was a little pissed off, to tell you the truth, because I didn't learn it when I was in school, and it was never mentioned, and it was whispered about, if even mentioned at all. And I don't think I'm that different from a lot of other Americans, who were not aware of that awful history and how it continues to influence our lives today. So that's really kind of the way it started. I was looking for people in Maryland who might have been researching this work, because his initial report was really concentrating on the 11 Confederate states in Kentucky, those 12 states. I thought someone must be doing this in Maryland. And I think it just reflects on my weakness as a researcher that I couldn't find someone who was really doing this. So I basically started doing it myself with a project with another friend. And as it developed, I learned more about it and was in contact with EJI. And then we did a soil collection at the site of a lynching here in Towson. And that's really when it started. I incorporated shortly after that, and we were on our way. I think it's necessary, not just because it's something that we should know about, but because why don't we know about it? Why has it been dismissed and neglected for so long, this part of our history? And I think it's critical to understand how this history of lynchings connects to 400 years of white supremacy and still does. One of the things that Bryan Stevenson will often say is that truth and reconciliation are sequential, which is to say that until you acknowledge the truth, there's no possibility of reconciliation. And I think, I like to think that, you know, where the truth, what we do, the Marilyn Lynching Memorial Project, is we're the truth part of that equation. We try to be. So, you know, we work to, you know, not only to educate people about this history, but to we advocate for the public acknowledgement of these crimes. You know, we do help with the historic markers, the soil collections, and things like that. And I think one critical element here is, you know, Sherrilyn Ifill talks about that projects of reconciliation demand of individuals and communities, and I'm quoting her now, the willingness to confront difficult truths and then take responsibility for injustice. So, you know, it's not enough to acknowledge it. It's we need to understand how it, you know, how it continues to influence our lives, and then to begin to, you know, with that understanding, do what we can to dismantle this machinery.
Right. So it's unearthing and then holding space for seeing the connections to where we are and how they filter into almost everything that we do, right? That it's connected to how we organize law, how we organize space, how we organize like geographic, like locations where people are allowed to live, where people feel comfortable or not comfortable living.
Well, I was going to say, you know, one way that it's kind of reflected in this, all this, you know, complex is reflected is, you know, I don't know if you know about the Red Maple Place project in East Towson, historic East Towson. Mm-hmm. There's this effort to place a massive brutalist, huge building of public housing units in East Towson against the wishes of the community, against the, you know, very vociferous wishes of the community. It's a historic East Towson, for people who don't know, was an historic African-American community. It was founded by slaves who were freed from the Ridgely Plantation, you know, where the Hampton Mansion is. Mm-hmm. And there are families that are still living there, you know, from descendants of those original founders. And the community has been decimated over the years by urban renewal. You know, it's a tale that's, I think, common in not just in Maryland, but in many parts of the country. The most unwanted public projects go, you know, will be funneled to the communities that have the least power and are the poorest. I think the people who are proposing this and who are backing this project, I don't think that they're necessarily racist. I don't believe that. Right. But I think this default position of oh, we'll put it in East Towson, that is where it comes in. You know, right after George Floyd was killed last, I read something that really was very clarifying for me by Barbara Smith, who is an intellectual and thinker up in Boston. Yes. Yeah, and so she wrote that white supremacy does not require individual bigotry to succeed, to be effective. She talked about white supremacy as an operating system. It's like a default, right? And so I think that's really liberating in a lot of ways, because first of all, I think it removes a lot of defensiveness from, you know, that question, but also it also separates intent from effect.
Right.
So I think it's important for us, you know, not only do we need to create public spaces where these tragedies and these awful crimes can be remembered and reckoned with, but it's also creating space in our understanding of the world and of how the world works. 10 years ago, we probably wouldn't have blinked when they want to put that, you know, the that project or Red Maple Place in Towson, in East Towson. But I think as we learn more about our history and about this history of lynching and how white supremacy works, we have a responsibility to question these things. And that's when the questions about, you know, whether or not it's an expression of white supremacy, this Red Maple Place, I think that's a valid question. And I think we have to start looking for ways to asking those kinds of questions and creating public spaces and reminding people of this history, forcing them to remember this history, is one way to prompt that, I think.
One of the things that's interesting, especially something as the historical trauma of something like lynching, is this there are some people that would approach this advocacy work as an intellectual exercise. But in the responses that you've been having as we've been talking, I hear passion underneath of it. And I think that's a little bit more of what I'm sort of wondering about. How do you stoke that passion, right? Because some people would see this as archival work, right? Without the passion, but I hear the passion. So.
Well, it is important to me, right? It's our country. It's all of our country. And one thing about all of this is that I'm stunned at the capacity for cruelty. That we did this and continue to do this to our own people. Unspeakable. It's reprehensible. No one is going to lead us by the hand to the garden of racial reconciliation. It's up to each of us to do what we can. And I think each of us can do something. And I think there's no greater contribution any American could make than to do something to help relieve us of this disease that we've suffered under for 400 years.
Yes. Yes. I guess my final question, and we could talk about this from a Baltimore perspective, but we can also think about it from a Maryland perspective. Like, how do you think our cities and our counties should hold collective historical trauma? Because as we're talking about the East Towson example, right, we have the tendency to build on top and build on top and build on top of horrors, right? Do you have any thoughts about how a place like Baltimore would be able to hold collective historical trauma?
I think it's important that we make space for that to happen, for people to, symbols are really important, and they communicate, cultural values, and they provide a public statement of what's important to us as a community or as a nation, and how we orient to our history. So I think for me, thinking about this work that we're doing with the markers and so on and so forth, I mean, we that's a prompt. We want people to, it's important to acknowledge that. We took the Confederate statues down for a reason.
Right.
And it's a good reason. Mm-hmm. So I think that when you're talking about holding this trauma, I think we need to make it a safe and a place in order to acknowledge that and act.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk about the Maryland Lynching Memorial Project. And also thank you so much for providing more context about the processes and the historical traumas that have occurred in East Towson. That's a conversation that's really close to my heart right now. And also thank you for the work and keeping your passion.
It's my pleasure. And thank you so much for having me, Dr. Young. I really enjoyed it.
I've been speaking to Will Schwartz. He is the president and founder of the Maryland Lynching Memorial Project. I'm Dr. Kalima Young, and you're listening to Future City here on 88.1 WYPR. We have to take a brief break, but don't go away. When we come back, I'll talk to Erica Bridgeford, co-creator of Baltimore Ceasefire 365, about how she and other anti-violence activists create sacred spaces in places where people have been killed in the city. Stay tuned. Welcome back. I'm Dr. Kalima Young, and this is Future City on 88.1 WYPR, the monthly show where we explore innovative responses to the city's most pressing issues and where we move the conversation from what's wrong to what's next. Today on the show, we're talking about collective trauma and grief and how artists, activists, and cities make space for holding them. Before we went to break, we spoke about memorializing the historical trauma of lynchings in Maryland. Now I'm joined by Erica Bridgeford. Erica Bridgeford is the co-creator of Baltimore Ceasefire 365, an organization that tries to stop homicides in Baltimore City. Erica Bridgeford, thanks for joining us on Future City. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm happy to be here.
Yay! I'm happy that you're here too. I love the work the Baltimore Ceasefire has been doing. Y'all been holding it down, holding on some space. So how did the Baltimore Ceasefire come to be?
So in 2015, when Baltimore hit 300 murders, at that time, I was a leader in the 300 Men March movement. And there was a guy who attended a meeting we called. There was a state of emergency meeting that we called for the community to attend. And this guy named Ogun was there because we had a common friend named Ooh. His name was Derek Jones. He had passed away not long before then. And so his friends were continuing the work he had been doing and being involved with the 300 Men March movement. So that's why Ogun was there. Mm-hmm. And he had this idea to just have one day where everybody in the city was agreeing to a ceasefire. He had told other people about that idea and had been shot down. Men, he had told. And so he came to me that day at the meeting and he said, look, I had this idea and I feel like you're somebody I'm supposed to talk to about it. And I got all excited and said, that's absolutely me. But it was 2 years before we really had the conversation. In 2017, my son was 19 at the time, and he said, Mom, did you know that the murder rate is higher than it's ever been in Baltimore? And I got really upset about what people should be doing to call a ceasefire. And then I remembered I was those people.
Ha ha! Ain't that something? That's how it always is.
You know, I'd heard this idea, so I shouldn't be blaming other people for what they're not doing if I'm not willing to do it myself.
Word.
So I called Ogun, and I had it was poured into my spirit that it shouldn't just be one day, but it should be 3 days. And this thing that if you're telling people not to do something, you should be replacing it with something for them to do instead. And yes. So absence of being violent, we're replacing it with let's celebrate life intentionally for these 3 days. And so those were the pieces that I added to it. Mm-hmm. And then we just, you know, we called the meeting and introduced it to community from there. At first, we were just calling a life over death weekend that we wanted to do in August. Mm-hmm. And who came to that first meeting named it Baltimore Ceasefire and Baltimore Peace Challenge. So the Peace Challenge part is right. To remind people who think that they're not violent, right, to remember, but are you as peaceful as you could possibly be? Probably not. And so here's an opportunity to use collective consciousness where all of us at the same time are intentionally being peaceful and celebrating life for 72 hours straight. Like, so I did not know how ready Baltimore was but the mm-hmm. thing is we have to remember that people are human, right? And just given the opportunity to celebrate life, given permission to celebrate life, people are going to choose life every single time.
Oh, yeah.
And that's all it was. It was just, you know, it really was just saying, hey, let's stop saying we're tired. Let's do the opposite of that. Like, whatever the thing is that's making us tired, let's do the opposite of that on purpose. Right. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. it meant that even people who are susceptible to being violent say, yes, during ceasefire weekends, I'm going to on purpose do something else. I'm going to pour into my community. I'm going to resolve conflict with people I haven't been speaking to. I'm going to avoid the people who I know I have conflict with if I feel like I might punch them in the face this weekend. Right. You know, like it mm-hmm. makes you just think, it just gives us a moment to pause and think about our reactions and our responses to one another. Because when you're doing it and everybody's doing it at the same time, mm-hmm. or at least everybody you know is participating in it, like that group consciousness and that collective think is now used for something positive so that you don't want to look like the odd person out who's intentionally being violent when you know everybody's trying to be peaceful. Like, you don't want to be that guy.
Right.
More people know about when ceasefire weekends are, what we see happening is the more people agree to accept the peace challenge, even if just for those 3 days. Because what it does inside of us is you can't now unremember that you were intentionally peaceful for 3 days. Even if you view yourself as somebody who pops off on people and mm-hmm. you okay, ceasefire weekend is coming. Let me watch my mouth. Let me watch how I respond, right? If you do that for 3 days, you now have started exercising that muscle inside of yourself. So when right. Monday comes and you want to go back to, oh, I just pop off on people, nobody better not try me, there's something in you now to say, hold on, sis.
Yep.
You know, you don't have to pop off. You just watch yourself not pop off for 3 days.
I love the idea of just giving people the chance to pause and for folks to respond and not react, right? Right? And this idea of the collective decision of everyone to buy into that, like, vibrates high. You can't not vibrate high when everybody around you is vibrating high.
That's exactly right. Your vibration raises just, even if it's just a little bit higher. And in relation to, like, so mm-hmm. for me, I would not have been, I didn't know this at the time, right? In mm-hmm. 2017, I didn't know. But now I know that who I was in 2015, mm-hmm. I was not prepared to handle what it would mean to birth the kind of movement that Baltimore Ceasefire is and has become and continues to grow into. Mm-hmm. The thing that I was going to need to navigate around, you know, just whatever people think an Erica Bridgeford is and how they respond to that, you know?
Right, like, right, right. You
know, I wouldn't have known that I would be called to go to almost every murder space every time somebody gets killed to bless the space. Had you told me, because I'm not a girl, I don't walk through the grass with no shoes on.
I got you.
If somebody had told me in 2015, you're going to be in the streets and alleys and on sidewalks and in fields in Baltimore, putting your lips, kissing the concrete where blood stains are, mm-hmm. I would have been like, you're crazy. You don't know me. I'm not doing that like this. No. I just always thought that I was going to be that person, right? And so
you got forced to walk in your purpose.
That's right. But in 2015, there were some things I had not experienced yet. There were some things I hadn't gone through yet that I needed to, that would gird me and prepare me and give me the authority to stand strong in this part of my purpose.
Man. Thinking about that, thinking about showing up strongly in your purpose, kissing the ground where someone has lost their life. Could you just give us a little bit of an understanding of what a sacred space ritual is? Because I don't think many people think about that at all.
So when the ceasefire movement first started, and even before then, just from the people I lost myself mm-hmm. to violence, I need to change that language. Not the people I lost, the people whose bodies were left behind, right? When their souls transitioned out of their bodies. Because violence happened to their bodies. Mm-hmm. I kept saying the places where murder happens needs to be sacred ground. I had been saying that for a while. I've been saying it in conversations with people. Mm-hmm. And then here comes the ceasefire movement. And a part of it, we had already determined if somebody gets killed during a ceasefire weekend, we're going to do two things. We're going to show up at the space. We're going to invite community to come with us to the space. We're going to intentionally pour love and light into that spot and into that neighborhood, so that murder does not have the last say or the last memory in this space. Mm-hmm. And we're going to find the family and give that family some kind of monetary love and support. Right. And they can use that money however they want. So when that happened during the first ceasefire, I was compelled to actually sit on the ground and put the palm of my hand and touch the concrete. I'm a hodgepodge of different kind of spiritual practices.
Me too.
I just think light and truth are where you find it. So I just pull pieces from, you know, wherever. And so then I do a Buddhist chant, Nam Myoho Renge Kyo. And there was one time I was chanting and I felt heat coming from the palm of my hand. Ooh. A year before the ceasefire was even a thought in my head, right? Mm-hmm. And so now somebody had been killed during the first ceasefire at a time in Baltimore where people were being killed every 19 hours. We went 41 hours this weekend, and then we got the phone call that somebody was killed. Go to the space. There are about 50 people there. And we're standing around the space. And people, you know, said whatever loving things and said prayers and sent love and light to the family and the person who was killed. And sent love and light to the person who had committed the murder. Because, of course, we want different choices for them, right?
Right.
And different opportunities of their own greatness and redemption and all of that kind of stuff, right? So we did all of those things. And as the crowd was dispersing, I remembered feeling heat coming out of the palm of my hand a year earlier. And so I was compelled to just sit on the ground and put the palm of my hand, put my body in the space where his body was. So there was something about it. I wasn't as clear about it then yet as I am now, but I just knew something about a body falling on concrete. People should not have that experience alone. A love-filled body should also have that experience where a pain-filled body fell, right? That without was the last thing this person saw, and you know, what did they see when they hit the ground? I just wanted to have that experience and pour my love and light into it just to help in their transition into another realm, right? So you're going to see us doing more where we're hosting trainings for people to facilitate sacred space rituals and, you know, supporting people so that others are also doing them.
Right.
Not mostly me and, you know, ceasefire squad members.
So how is the experience of sort of training people to tap into that kind of work and tap into that connection to spirit and land? How has that experience been, training people to do that?
It's amazing just because when people understand, like, it's not as deep and spooky as you think it is. People are like, well, I got to be a minister or some kind of shaman or some kind of,
like, it's just like, no, you could just be human like all of us.
You are love and light. Like, let's just say, like, you are that energy. And so if you are called, if there's something about a particular murder that makes you go, oh my goodness, your heart just cracked open. Let that love and light crack out of your heart into the physical space. And it literally just means you can show up with whatever. And, you know, it can be 5 minutes of I'm just going to show up and speak some words of peace and love into this neighborhood, into this spot. And then I'm getting in my car and I'm going home. Like, it doesn't have to be a whole anything much deeper than that. It really is whatever. So this is a self-determination movement, Baltimore 65 is. So even with this, you get to determine what is pouring light and love into a spot look like for you. And that's what we teach people, right? Whatever that means. So yes, then you hold space that people are not allowed to come to a sacred space ritual and get on their soapbox about what's wrong with Baltimore. There's enough of negative energy about Baltimore in the space already, right?
Right.
There's no revenge welcome in that space. Only love and light and honoring life in that space. And whatever that looks like to you, you show up and do that. So for me, I have done it based in religion, right? But if you are a religious person, then your sacred space ritual may look like the steps and principles of your religious practice is how you pour love and light into that space. And so even just the diversity of the ways love and light can show up is one reason why it's important for it not to mostly be me and ceasefire squad members who are doing it, right? That it is Baltimore gets to remember its light because people have permission to show up and pour love and light into a community. Now, we're going to have we have logistics about it, right? So we're going to make sure that people have on, because we've learned some things in doing it, right, these years. And so, for example, people now, if they see the Baltimore ceasefire logo, they trust whoever's wearing that t-shirt.
Right.
Like, it's just a weird thing. Like, if I show up and just say, well, can somebody tell us where the person was shot, like, you know, where their body fell? Because we're wearing a ceasefire t-shirt, people end up telling us all kinds of things about what happened. People in Baltimore trusted police uniforms the way they trust the ceasefire logo. This whole city looked different.
I got one last question for you, then I'll let you roll on with the beautiful work that you do. What do you think that cities can do to hold collective trauma that is ongoing, right? Because the way I've been thinking about sort of thinking in the future cities, this conversation we've been having is like historical trauma and then systemic trauma. What are some ways that you think that cities can hold collective cultural trauma that is ongoing, that doesn't have an endpoint? Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, so I think that's a big question. And I think there are baby step kinds of things that can happen, but just intentional things. So like a place like Baltimore, when you said like the trauma is right beneath the ground. So when you just think about the indigenous tribes, right,
yes,
that are native to Baltimore, honoring those tribes, honoring the land, doing things like taking down Confederate statues and getting rid of Columbus Day and getting rid of Columbus statues. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, yeah.
Honoring and being honest and rawly transparent that tribes were wiped off the face of the planet that no longer exists because of the myth of white supremacy, right? Yes. And violent systems of oppression. And yes, so in Baltimore, like a city like Baltimore, we can be honest about that. We can work with indigenous people who are still here to say, what is it that you need? What is the work you're doing? How can we support that work, right? But then things like the trauma-informed task force, you know, that came out of students in Baltimore, Black and brown students being traumatized by losing their friends to gun violence and then having to go to school the next day and saying our teachers and administration don't have a clue about how to deal with the trauma that we're facing, losing our friends to gun violence. And they went to city council. Y'all need to do something about that. Like, you know,
right.
And Elijah Cummings going, you're all right, we do need to do something about that. And then city council, like, moving it forward to now there is a task force that's really thinking through how to make sure Baltimore is a more trauma-informed city, right? Yes. And so those are just some examples, but like, and then just all the good community work that is happening. Recently, Let's Thrive Baltimore reached out to us to say, hey, a lot of young people have been killed recently. Can we do peace vigils at the same time in different places all over the city where we're just asking people to show up together and light candles and do whatever they want to do in those spaces? So all these different T-shirts from different nonviolence, you know, movements, all at the vigils in different places around the city together, and council people showed up and state delegates showed up. And you know what I mean?
Right,
so like this continuing, answer the call on your heart is my short answer to that question. Whether we are a politician, an activist, or an elder that just sit in on our porch all day and look out the window, all of us have a call in our hearts. Answer the call in your heart.
Thank you, Erica. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That was just okay, magic time. I appreciate that and appreciate your thoughts and your passion and fully support the work that you're doing.
So, thank you so much.
I've been speaking to Erica Bridgeford. Erica Bridgeford is the co-creator of Baltimore Ceasefire 365. I'm Dr. Kalima Young, and you're listening to Future City here on 88.1 WYPR. We have to take a brief break, but don't go away. When we come back, I'll speak to Hannah Brancato about the Monument Quilt, a project that creates safe space for stories of survivors of sexual assault. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Dr. Kalima Young, and this is Future City on 88.1 WYPR, the monthly show where we explore innovative responses to the city's most pressing issues and where we move the conversation from what's wrong to what's next. Today on the show, we're talking about collective trauma and grief and how artists, activists, and cities make space for holding them. For our final segment, we're talking about a public healing project for survivors of sexual assault and abuse called the Monument Quilt. Joining us to talk about this is Hannah Brancato, co-founder of Force Upsetting Rape Culture. The Monument Quilt is near and dear to my heart, as I served as a leadership team member of the project since its inception in 2013. So Hannah Brancato, welcome to Future City.
How you doing?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
So how did the Monument Quilt come to be?
Yeah, so the Monument Quilt is a project by the collective Force Upsetting Rape Culture. And it was founded in 2013 by me and Rebecca Nagel when we had started to do some anti-sexual violence activism, especially around promoting and creating a new culture based on consent. And in doing that kind of visionary work, we realized that in order to build that future reality, we also needed to reckon with the reality of how many people are survivors of sexual violence and create more space for our stories to be held and recognized, and especially for our communities to support us in public. And back in 2013, the conversation was in a very different place than it is today. So that's really the beginning. We were talking about the fact that there was no existing monument to survivors of sexual violence, and the monument quilt was all about creating temporary monuments that could pop up in places all around the country. And we ended up also doing the project in Mexico over the period of time. And ultimately, it landed on the National Mall in 2019 for a culminating display. And it was a very collective effort over time. So it was co-founded by Rebecca and I, but the project was made real by, you know, Shanti Flagg, who over the years was managing the studio, by all of the people who were part of the collective over the years, by you and all of the members of the leadership team. So it was an extremely collaborative and collective effort over 6 years.
Could you tell us just a little bit about its final culminating display that happened in the 2019? So what was involved in that? Well, other than a huge, huge project, of course.
Yeah. So over the years, survivors and their allies created quilts that either contain their own stories or messages of support. And we collected 3,000 of those stories over time. And so this final event in DC in 2019 blanketed the National Mall with Not Alone and No Está Sol, Not Alone in Spanish. The quilts were laid out across the National Mall over a mile to spell out those two phrases. And around the perimeter of the quilt were intentional spaces created by members of the leadership team. And they had opportunities for people to take a break, to engage in healing, to share their own story, to connect with other people that were part of the project. There was music, there was art making, there were opportunities to connect with community. There was a survivor convening that was organized as part of the display to talk about policy solutions. So it was a 3-day, like, multifaceted event.
Right, right. It's definitely a communal project, right? It was a large communal project. Can you tell us what the process for creating the quilt looked like, putting all of that together?
The monument quilt was created in a studio in Baltimore. And at first that studio was on Greenmount Avenue, and then it moved to Area 405. And then it was in the Motor House on North Avenue in the final location. Shanti managed that studio from 2014 onward and organized hundreds of volunteers over the years to come in and help us sew quilts together. So what would happen is that we put together workshop materials, and those workshop materials were co-created with lots of advisors and smart people to create a way for people to participate in the project. Mm-hmm. And then people would make their quilts and they would mail them to us, and then we would sew them together in the studio. And so, and by we, I mean Shanti and like the hundreds of volunteers that she mobilized to come in. Yeah, so it was pretty incredible. Donated sewing machines, volunteer days, like, you know, lots of like just like noise and chaos and community. And I think people, you know, I think the project was healing for people on a lot of different levels, like individually right. making their quilts. But I also think volunteering to come into the studio was something that felt connective and empowering as well.
Right. Is there something unique about textiles or art in general for holding collective grief? Because a quilt is a very specific kind of art making and craft making. Is there something that's unique about the using of textiles or art in general to say things that maybe we have trouble saying in other ways?
Yes, I have so many thoughts on this question.
Well, you're an artist, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few different answers. Like, one is, yes, we're building on so many histories of quilt making, and then quilts themselves, you know, fabric contains history, and I think carries memory. Mm-hmm. You know, even just like in a physical way, right? Like if a piece of fabric is creased and it's wrinkled, like that's the memory of the fabric, right? So yeah, I think fabric holds memory in many different ways. It's like a representation of, it can be like family and generational legacies. Quilts are things that can be passed down through families. So that's part of why quilts for this project, because we were thinking about, you know, child sexual abuse and creating new narratives for families. And this project, in fact, did for many families, I think, open up space to have conversations about violence that had happened within people's families. And, you know, why fabric, you know, I think, yeah, it relates to all of these traditions. Then there's the process of making the quilts and healing from trauma. You know, trauma is held in the body, right? Mm-hmm. As we know, whether it's trauma that we directly experienced or generational trauma through our ancestors, right?
Right.
And so, yeah, like the embodied act of making something has to be a part of working through that trauma. And this is something that, like, I continue to learn more and more about through, you know, I think that there was an instinctual way that we started making the monument quilt, and then reading books like The Body Keeps the Score, or, you know, now I'm reading My Grandmother's Hands.
My Grandmother's Hands. Yes. Oh my God, that book.
Yes. Woo. It's amazing. It's just incredible. And those, some of the activities, you know, these mindfulness activities of looking around you are just so deeply profound, right? So, and they get you right in the gut. So My Grandmother's Hands being about racial trauma specifically, and The Body Keeps the Score is about sexual trauma. But yeah, so I think the quilt making, like, there was a way that we just knew that we needed people to be able to get out of their heads and be able to tell their stories, maybe using words, but not only using words, because with words, there's a way that we're performing our story. So to be able to get beyond that. But yeah, so now we're working on archiving the quilts, and what that looks like is finding permanent homes in dispersed locations for sections of the monument quilt. So there are 3,000 stories, and those stories are on 758-foot quilt blocks. And so the goal is for every single one of those quilt blocks to have a permanent home and be in the care of a person or institution that's going to preserve and continue to tell the story of the project and of the particular quilt square or squares that they collect. And, you know, that way it has an ongoing life. To me, this archive actually does create a permanence to this very impermanent project. Because, you know, when the quilts are displayed at a place like the Baltimore Museum of Art, who collected 10 quilt squares, and it's a huge deal, and it's extremely affirming to all the survivors that made those quilts. When they show that quilt again, it carries the story forward. So it didn't just stop in 2019. It means it can have a life, you know, from here on out. And it can continue to serve that purpose of raising the issue, putting sexual assault in the public view. You know, right now, in the aftermath of the Me Too movement, sexual violence is a more public conversation than it was in 2013. And as we've seen in anti-sexual violence activism, there are ebbs and flows, I would say, in attention, especially related to grief and trauma. I think sometimes people just want to take a vacation from it, which is reasonable. We should all take breaks and rest a lot. And, you know, I think the ongoing presence of this project in institutions will guarantee that it has a life.
Yeah, definitely.
So for any listeners who may have access to places that archive, could you tell us really briefly what a person would have to do or an institution would have to do to be able to hold on to the legacy of the monument quilt?
Yes, absolutely. So, the minimum, number of quilts people could collect is one block. So, for institutions, we're kind of suggesting more like 10, but if you're an individual, it would be one. You need to just be able to commit to preserving that quilt, to keeping it safe, dry, and protected, and also making sure that that quilt will be seen. So committing to displaying and doing programming related to that quilt.
Awesome.
Force is act force it is not doing active programming anymore, and all of the efforts of the collective now is Shanti Flagg and Mora Fernandez. They're the two collective members leading this archiving effort, and I'm in a supportive role as the
Awesome.
co-founder. I just want to make sure these quilts find a home, so folks can connect with any of us to we and we can maybe put contact information in the show notes or something like that.
Okay.
Or people can also visit the website, themonumentquilt.org, to find information about how to get in touch. But we're asking for, some kind of a donation for the value of the quilts as well, to help us continue to do this archiving work. Moving forward,
Awesome.
because we have found homes for about, I think it's about 70 quilts now, which is
Okay,
huge and
that
very
is.
exciting. And we still have to find homes for 680 quilts. So it will be life's work. And
Yes.
but any institution or person that collects a quilt, will become a part of history by doing so. So I think it's a really cool opportunity.
Yep. Yes, it definitely is. Thank you so much, Hannah, for joining us on Future City and letting us know about the monument quilt and the beautiful work and the efforts to archive it and to do some dreaming and visioning about next steps for Baltimore and how we here in this city can make an ongoing space for those who've experienced sexual and domestic violence because it impacts all of us. So thanks so much.
Thank you, Kalima.
Systemic trauma refers to negative environmental and institutional policies and procedures that create trauma and maintain it. Historical trauma is multi-generational trauma experienced by a specific cultural, racial, or ethnic group. Personal trauma is an individual response to the violence inflicted upon a person by those more powerful or by institutions more powerful. No matter the form it takes, trauma results in a reorganization of the way minds and bodies perceive and respond to the world at large. To create a just and equitable city, we must first acknowledge that trauma exists. We then bring to light the traumatic histories embedded in the earth beneath our feet, such as Maryland's lynching history. Finally, we must build more containers like the Monument Quilt and Baltimore Ceasefire 365 that are large and diverse enough to hold our collective grief. Future City is produced and edited by Mark Gunnery. We welcome your feedback, and you can email us with your thoughts and questions about the show at futurecity@wypr.org. If you want to learn more about some of the people and organizations we heard from today, or if you want to listen to previous episodes, please visit wypr.org and search for Future City. Future City airs on WYPR on the fourth Wednesday of each month at 1 p.m. and at 9 p.m. Until next time, for 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station, I'm Dr. Kalima Young. Take care.
Future City is made possible by McCormick & Company. Through its Flavor for Life program, McCormick helps teach kids and families in Baltimore how to replace salt, sugar, and fat. More information can be found at McCormickCorporation.com.